My name's Richard Dennis, Chief Economist at the Australia Institute. You're listening to The Lucky Country, a weekly podcast brought to you by Schwartz Media, the publisher of The Monthly, The Saturday Paper, and Australia's first fossil fuel-free super fund, Future Super. The Saturday Paper's my source of quality long-form journalism every weekend, and The Monthly is the country's best magazine of politics, culture and ideas. They even publish some of mine from time to time. This episode I'll be talking to two people whose lives revolve around changing their part of the world. I'll be talking to Chief Minister of the ACT, Andrew Barr, about how his government manages to do things like introduce a 100% renewable energy target for 2020 and keep getting elected. I'll also be talking to Indira Naidu about how more and more people are growing more of their own food in order to save themselves some money and save a lot of other things as well. And then I'll be joined by Chris Fry for our Sensible Centre segment. Today we'll be talking about euthanasia. Thanks for joining me. The idea that individuals can change the world, or at least part of it, is the theme of my latest book called Curing Affluenza, How Buying Less Stuff Can Save the World. It'll be out at the end of the month. We'll put some details about launch events up at the end of the podcast. Hopefully you can come along.
We have to ensure that we remain a high-wage, first-world, generous social welfare net economy, and that requires strong economic growth. How do we maintain that? Well, there's a big, expanding global economy with, you know, many more avenues for Australian services and exports and manufacturers and primary products. And all of that's very exciting. So, but we need to be competitive, we need to be productive, we need, above all, to be more innovative.
Can individuals make a difference, or do we need global leadership to change the world? Can local communities and councils make a difference? Or is anything less than national or international policy change just not worth the effort? It's easy to convince yourself, or be convinced by others, that the decisions we make as individuals or at a community level don't really matter when there's 7.5 billion other people on the planet in a global economy worth more than $100 trillion per year. But what if I told you there was no such thing as the global economy? I'm not saying we don't live on a globe, and I'm not saying it doesn't have lots of economic activity on it. But I am saying there's no such thing as the global economy. There are factories all around the world, and farms, and hospitals, and universities, and shops. You can find all of them on Google Maps. But no matter how hard you look, you won't find the global economy. What we call the global economy is nothing more than the sum of those 7.5 billion parts. And while we're often made to feel like the global economy shapes us, in reality, we get to shape it every time we take a job, quit a job, spend a dollar, invest a dollar, decide to keep chickens in our backyard rather than buy eggs. I'm not saying that you're in charge of the global economy. I'm saying no one is. And I'm not saying that everyone's got the same capacity to shape the global economy. But I am saying that everybody has some capacity, and everybody's decisions really do count. Take smartphones, for example. 10 years ago, almost no one in the world had a phone on which they could read the news, book a flight, or read a book. In a country like Australia, almost everyone's got one today. People's spending decisions have changed the world, radically, in less than a decade. 20 years ago, almost nobody bought takeaway coffee. And when I was growing up, I'd never been out for breakfast, once, not in my life. I was in my 20s before I first paid someone to cook me eggs. But today, cafes are one of the biggest employers in the Australian economy, and indeed they're one of the biggest employers in most rich countries. But now imagine if all the money that Australians spend on coffee or Eggs Benedict was spent on soft drink and chocolate bars. Would the shape of your city and our economy be different? Of course it would. Or what if the money we spend on coffee was spent instead increasing funding for health, education, public transport, or any other public services? Surely our economy would look different if we made different choices. To be clear, I'm not saying you shouldn't drink coffee. Indeed, I buy at least two every single day. And I'm not saying that we can't have high-quality public services if we want to drink coffee. What I am saying is that our individual spending decisions matter, our community spending decisions matter, and that globally, the demand for things like coffees and smartphones isn't decided by the global economy. It's decided by each of us every time we put our hand in our wallets. I'm I'm now joined by the ACT Chief Minister, Andrew Barr. Andrew has been Chief Minister since 2014 and has been a member of the ACT Legislative Assembly since 2006. Andrew, what's it like leading a minority government? It must be chaos.
No, Richard, it has its challenges from time to time when you obviously need to compromise and to find an agreed path forward on a particular issue. But I actually find, and it's the norm in the ACT, that sort of government arrangement keeps you on your toes, ensures that your own colleagues are a little bit more disciplined, because you know, every vote tends to count in minority government situations.
So you're suggesting that dealing with other people and communicating a lot actually helps get things done?
That's a pretty strong motivating factor when you're short of the required votes on the floor of the parliament at any given time. I think it's important to have a strong written framework for how a government will operate in those circumstances. And so the experience in the ACT over numerous minority governments has been that it's useful to have that framework and then have a dispute resolution mechanism of sorts. I mean, ultimately, these things are about relationships between people in the end and how you manage on those occasions where there's strong differences of opinion. But coming together at the beginning of a parliamentary term with an agreed and shared agenda, noting that it wouldn't be the only things that respective parties would pursue in a parliamentary term, but that there was agreement on these areas of common desire, if you like, that is a very powerful and effective way to manage a government.
Wow, not just talking to other people, but setting long-term goals and working towards them. This sounds like crazy talk.
I think we've proved in the ACT over a number of parliamentary terms now that is possible and that election after election we can make progress on a number of issues that are important to our community and important to both the elected members of respective governing parties but also to the grassroots of those parties.
As a proud Canberran, I'll come back to some of those achievements in a minute. But before we do, obviously New Zealand's just elected a new government. It looks like being a minority government, a multiple coalition with Winston Peters and relying on the support of the Greens as well. Obviously, all jurisdictions are different. But what's your advice to any leader winding up in a situation like that?
Well, clearly the negotiating process ahead of Winston Peters' announcement must have seen some compromise and agreements to pursue a shared agenda. Now, across a multi-party coalition where it would appear that the Labor Party is dealing with a party to the left of it and a party to the right of it, there is undoubtedly some management challenges there, but it would appear, and obviously with the government forming the way it's going to, that there are areas of shared desire for reform and for a different approach in New Zealand. So they really do need to focus their work on those areas and to seek to build momentum in delivering the change that they've advocated for during the election campaign. And do the best job they can to not be distracted by what an opposition might throw at them or other events that undoubtedly transpire. The business of governing is as much about how you can spend your time on the issues that you were elected to deliver results on, spend more time on that and less time being distracted by other things.
Well, look, you said before that being in minority government sometimes makes it a bit easier to deal with your own colleagues because discipline is so important and every vote counts. Do you think that when you have to negotiate with people outside your own party that in turn it makes it easier to explain to the electorate that compromise is inevitable, that everyone's not going to get what they want, but if people work together, they might get something?
Yeah, the short answer is yes, and I think that applies equally to your own parliamentary colleagues. They all interact on a daily basis in a parliamentary environment where they know that achieving the outcomes they want require compromise, persuasion, and that process, I think, can actually aid policy development. Issues that you may not necessarily have thought of in advance of releasing a policy can be raised with your governing partners or raised by them. There have certainly been times in the ACT context over the last 10 years where something I hadn't immediately thought of has been brought to my attention before we've gone public with it, and I guess saved a degree of difficulty in the public explaining, because someone from a, you know, looking at it from a slightly different perspective raises a quite legitimate point. Now, this doesn't always work perfectly, and there will always be times when there's disagreement between parties in a minority government arrangement. But look at the Australian Parliament at the moment. There's disagreement within a governing party who's also notionally has a parliamentary majority, but they have quite extreme ranges of opinion on a bunch of pretty significant issues for the nation. So, look, I think in the end, different electoral systems will clearly dictate different forms of political behaviour. But anyone who operates in a proportional representation system in a modern Western democracy really has to deal with multi-party government, and that's how it works.
In the ACT, in recent years, we've seen the introduction of land tax reform. We've seen the massive investment in light rail and, of course, the 100% renewable energy target. All of these issues were controversial. The opposition was highly critical of them at times. Yet your government and your predecessors have won successive elections, introducing big tax reform, big energy reform and big public transport reform. Do you just kind of look at all the other premiers and chief ministers and have a chuckle from time to time when they say they can't get anything done?
Well, look, there's different environments in different states and territories and different...
You're being very diplomatic.
Different
Andrew.
Issues. But I'll make the observation that if you're in politics to achieve things and you believe in the policy reforms that you are implementing, the electorate sees that. If you've developed the policies carefully, you take into account as best you can the change management process that comes from implementing a significant economic or social policy change. You've given thought to that. You're prepared to expend political capital, however that is defined, and that can be just in the context of continuously having to debate particular topics, which certainly has been the case in the ACT, where those three issues you've raised have been the subject of seemingly about 8 years of political debate and three election campaigns in some contexts. You've got to be persistent, you've got to have the courage of your convictions and be prepared to have people disagree, and in some instances it might lose you some votes. But my experience in the ACT has been, by and large, where I may have lost some votes on some issues, I've picked up others because we've pursued the policy agenda that we have, and that it's been clear and consistent and implemented well over an extended period. So people, I think, not only mark you on your policy intent, but also how you go about delivering a particular reform as well.
Well, I'm shamelessly plugging my latest book in this podcast, Andrew, and you've kindly agreed to launch it for me. The premise of the book is that individuals can make a difference, and that communities might not be able to change the world, but they can inspire the world to change. What's your advice to people, young people in particular, wondering whether it's worth getting engaged in politics? You seem to have done all right out of it. What do you think others should be doing?
Well, look, I certainly agree with the premise that individuals can make a difference. Individuals working with other individuals collectively on particular wicked problems can achieve remarkable results. I think in the end, if you look at what's the alternative to not participate, to not seek to make the world a better place? That to me just seems a little bit hopeless in that regard. So you're not always going to get every outcome that you want immediately. Speaking as a Generation Xer, I do observe in some of my younger colleagues a level of impatience around the reform process that when seeking to mentor the next generation of politicians, I do always advise them that change doesn't always come easily and that it's not just going to happen immediately, but with persistence you can achieve a quite significant change. And I make the observation more broadly that as the world through technology gets much closer together, there's a much more global sense of engagement now than there was several decades ago. what happens at a local level is indeed even more important and can inspire change elsewhere in the world. So never think that your engagement at a local level is meaningless. It's not, and it definitely does impact locally, then potentially nationally, and sometimes in this global world, you'll get local change leading to international change that might finally see national change. And a very good example of that in the ACT has been advocacy around equal rights for gay and lesbian people that began in this territory decades and decades ago and might ultimately result in a national outcome in Australia. Somewhat behind many other parts of the world, but nevertheless, the local advocacy in Canberra has made a big difference.
Look, it certainly has. And every day when I watch that tram getting built and I see progress, but also I realise that the 2020 target for 100% renewable energy once seemed like a long way away, and now it seems like it's just around the corner. So, Andrew Barr, thanks for joining us on The Lucky Country, and thanks for driving some of those big reforms through that make our city, but hopefully our country, an even luckier place to live.
My pleasure, Richard. Thank you very much.
That was Chief Minister of the ACT, Andrew Barr. Our next guest is Indira Naidu, former television presenter and now champion of community gardening and author of The Edible City. Indira Naidu, I've just been speaking to the ACT Chief Minister, who's very proud of the light rail project his government's overseeing, but you think there's some unfinished business in the ACT.
Well, Richard, what I think is really fascinating about getting involved and digging into this issue of edible landscapes and looking at our wasted urban spaces in our cities is that Walter Burley Griffin and his wife that came up with the original plan for Canberra and how it should look at the turn of last century had envisaged Canberra to be a city that had light rail, that had mixed horticulture and animal rearing and pig farms and food forests. And so it's, when people go to Canberra now and they think, why are they all these separate nodes and everything seems not connected? Well, because the original plan was never put into practice. And when you look at the original plan, you can see that the light rail was meant to connect all the different suburbs and there would be, you know, pigs and hens and chickens and citrus forests. And it was all part of the way Canberra was meant to look rather than the disjointed feel we get there in the city. So it's very exciting for me that the current ACT leadership is looking to put into place some of those original concepts.
So tell me, I mean, how would our cities be better places to live in if more people were growing more food? What are the upsides here?
The big problem we have in our cities is that most of the food that we eat comes from very, very far away, putting pressure on other environments and transport systems. And obviously now with climate change, our carbon footprints, things like that, we have to look at different ways that not only we can grow our food, but grow our food for a growing population and grow our food for a growing population in a way that doesn't put more pressure on our fragile planet.
So we can save some money, we can certainly save the environment, we can actually have the convenience of some fresh food and herbs just there whenever we want them. You make it sound so good, why don't more people do it?
I think there's a corporatisation of our food system that's happened over the last 50 years. And the corporates involved and the big ag that's involved has passed on messages that we've all believed, that time is too precious to waste it. Cooking your own food will do that all for you. All of us used to grow and cook all our own food. In just 100 years, most of us don't do either of those things. So I'm fascinated about how that turnaround has taken place and whether we have benefited at all. Yes, we've got more leisure time, but what we've sacrificed is, and this is what I've discovered from growing vegetables myself, is that it's not a drudgery growing your own food. It's not boring and inconvenient having to cook my own meals. I love it. I look forward to it. And for me, it's that act of trying to grow my own food, I think, is a real important political act because the system is against you. It's telling you it's too difficult. You don't have the time. You don't have the space. You don't have the skills. So when you act against it, it is quite a statement, it's quite a political act to say, no, I can take control of my food back and it's going to be better for me.
Well, on that political act, what can individuals or communities do to make literally more room for gardens in our communities? What's holding us back at a collective level?
Well, again, it's just lack of imagination. I think it's as basic as that. My second book, The Edible City, documents 6 or 7 communities that have said, we want to take control over our food system for our community, save some money and grow together, you know, in a healthy way. And they have just seconded rooftop space or the verge next to a road or dug up the old tarmac on a school tennis court. I mean, we've got so many of these wasted spaces. If we really look, they're everywhere. And lots of herbs and vegetables can be grown in pots, in hanging wall systems. They don't need that much room, just a little bit of water and some sunlight, and off they go. For me, it's about communities understanding that they can demand how their environment is used. They put the councillors there, they vote to the politicians. Rather than just being subjected to these decisions, they can be actively involved and really create the world and the future and the, you know, the natural wonder around them that they want for themselves and their family.
Wow, you make it seem like democracy might even work sometimes. Indira Naidu, thanks so much for joining us on The Lucky Country.
It's my pleasure. Thanks a lot, Richard.
That was Indira Naidu, author of The Edible Balcony and The Edible City. I'm now joined by Chris Fry for our Sensible Centre segment. Chris is usually described as being a little bit to the right of me, and today we'll be talking about euthanasia. Chris, usually we hear a lot about federal parliament, but state parliament's leading the drive this week. Euthanasia, for it or against it?
I'm certainly for it. I presume you're talking about voluntary euthanasia.
Well, you tell me.
Well, look, there is actually a case, in my view, for compulsory euthanasia.
God.
We've all thought about that. But at the moment, I'm very pro voluntary euthanasia, but only in the sense if the person involved genuinely wants it. There are risks around this, which no doubt we'll talk about. But as a philosophical issue, I think it's very, very clear that this is a fundamental human right.
So why do so many conservatives oppose it? And indeed, why does Paul Keating and Kevin Rudd oppose it? What's going on? What's the conservative argument against giving individuals choice over such an important decision?
Well, I haven't discussed this with any of them, obviously, but I don't think it's their opinion. It's something that was inculcated into them when they were little children via the churches. It's an irrational and absurd position that under no circumstances ever is someone allowed to voluntarily seek their life. And I don't think it is a conservative position. I think it's a religious, philosophical position. And that's why I don't hold it.
So where's this going to wind up if Victoria actually legalises voluntary euthanasia? Do you expect other states and territories to follow suit?
I think irrespective of whether it gets up or not, that they will. I think the next cab off the rank probably should be the federal parliament should overturn the outrageous ban that was instituted by an extremely conservative member of parliament, the member for Menzies, to override the right of the territory legislatures to follow the wishes of their electors in this matter. I can't remember the precise timing, but it was about 20 years ago that the Northern Territory famously introduced such legislation with the overwhelming support of the public and the religious faction within the Howard government overrode it by taking away the power for either the ACT or the Northern Territory to legislate in this space at all. That is very undemocratic. And it is still the law, and in my view, that should be the next cab off the rank.
And if that's not changed, presumably we'll start to see people moving from one state to another to access a service that's clearly widely supported in the community.
Look, I think that's right. Can I say, just by chance, I had lunch with a good friend yesterday who's working for the dark side on this issue in Victoria, and he was telling me about the term that they had coined, which is called suicide tourism. And he was disparaging it, obviously. Whereas to me, that could be better than the Women's Weekly, World Discovery Tour. To me, there's nothing more fundamental than choosing your exit strategy, as long as you properly choose it. And the notion that the state should stop you actively from doing it and criminalise both you, your loved ones, and indeed medical people who are involved, it's absurd to me, and it's absurd that the people who talk about freedom claim that that's what they're doing. It's the opposite.
So I know you love to speak on behalf of all Conservatives, but on this show, that's the job I've given you. What is the argument? How do people who want individuals to have choice of superannuation, choice of bank, choice of school, choice of everything, how does your friend who's working for the dark side, as you said, convince themselves that people shouldn't have choice over something so significant?
Well, his is a philosophical one. He's a very religious guy, and I respect that choice. That's completely fine. And he normally doesn't want to impose his views on other people, but I just think that they have a fundamental view, which is freedom means my values. This is a collective term. And anybody who doesn't agree with my values is against freedom. It's nothing to do with it, of course. If you could add another one into the thing, there was a time when they didn't want government in your life too much, or indeed in the bedroom. But of course, many of the same people, are completely homophobic and completely and utterly obsessed by people's personal lives and whether or not they can get married, etc. So I don't think it's a conservative position. I think it's the fact that the religious right has become the dominant voice, if you like, within what used to be conservatism, and it's drowned out the more reasonable things. We've seen it more in America, but the trend is very worrying here. You know, there's a particular person who's very prominent in these issues who wants to come back to national leadership on the basis of this. I'm sure he will fail, but we all need to be, I think, careful in this space about being honest. If people have religious views, that's fine. Then that means they're religious views and they should be expressed that way. It is not the same thing to assert that all religious views are conservative views, because certainly in my view, they're not.
Well, conservatives seem to be fighting uphill battles on same-sex marriage and euthanasia at the moment. But in a democracy, of course, it's not up to which side is right or wrong, but what the overwhelming majority of the public think. Do you think that the conservative side of politics is doing themselves harm by picking these battles and fighting them so hard?
I do, and I would say that because I don't agree with their position. But can I say that there's a very sensible way through this, and that will hoist some of these hypocrites on their own petard. I have no problem, as I've said before to you, it's a waste of money, but I have no philosophical problem with asking people, by way of a survey or a proper plebiscite or whatever, their views on difficult questions. We'll see how the marriage one ends up, and today we're going to get some more participation figures. But despite some obvious flaws, that's been pretty successful, and I think that will genuinely reflect majority will. Why can't we do the same on these other difficult matters, such as euthanasia, decriminalising abortion where that still exists, all of these things which is just too difficult for some people to deal with because of their philosophy, should be given to the people. And I think overwhelmingly then the unrepresentative nature of many of our parliaments will also be shown up.
Sounds like you think we need to be outsourcing some more democracy, but it might actually get us some better decisions. Chris Fry, thanks for joining us in the Sensible Centre.
Mate, it's great for you to come and meet me in the Sensible Centre, as usual.
Any day. Thank you.
Bye.
That was Chris Fry joining us in the Sensible Centre.
So what overwhelmingly drove growth over the course of the past year was, as I said today, Australians going out to work every day, Australians starting and running businesses, Australians getting jobs, Australians going out there and fighting for every inch of growth that's out there in the global economy.
We've covered a lot of ground in today's episode with ACT Chief Minister Andrew Barr, Indira Naidoo and Chris Fry all giving us good examples of how individuals can not just shape their own life, but shape their community and indeed the nation and potentially the world. There's no such thing as the global economy. It's not in charge of us, and we're not in charge of it. But what we are in charge of is the things we buy, the things we do, the things our community spends more money on, and the things our community spends less money on. We do have the ability, whether it's to have a 100% renewable energy target in the ACT, or to have euthanasia reform in Victoria, or same-sex marriage reform across the country. These are decisions that we can influence. The globe influences us, and we influence the globe. It's not either, it's not or, it's always got to be both. But unfortunately in Australia, many people have been told for a long time now that we don't have the ability to make these big choices. Of course we do. We're one of the richest countries in the world. That's one of the reasons we're a lucky country. Whether we make good decisions or not is up to us, but every time we make one, we shouldn't underestimate the influence we have on other people. It's not just where we spend our money and how we vote that counts. It's what we tell our colleagues, it's what we tell our fellow citizens we want the world to look like. As Indira Naidu said, it's all about imagination. Well, that brings us to the end of this week's episode. The Lucky Country is a Schwartz Media production brought to you by Australia's first fossil fuel-free super fund, Future Super. You can email us any questions you have about the economy to theluckycountry@schwartzmedia.com.au. The show is produced by Andy Hazel. I'm Richard Dennis, and I'll be back with another edition of The Lucky Country next week. Thanks for listening. As I said earlier, a lot of what we've talked about in this episode is covered in my latest book, Curing Affluenza: How Buying Less Stuff Can Save the World. We've got book launches coming up in cities around the country in the coming weeks. All the details can be found on the Lucky Country website, or just search Curing Affluenza Book Launches. I'm sure you know how to do it.